Hello and welcome to the Fork in the Road podcast. It's been a long time since I've done one of these. I've been illustrating the second kid's book for Elijah and Crumpet, and then kind of partway along I started creating NFTs for Elijah and Crumpet, and then I created my own NFTs, and like I got kind of sucked into this NFT world, and I've been mucking around with non-fungible tokens, that is, in a platform called VoiceHQ, a platform which makes it really simple for artists to be able to get their work out there to the world without having to worry about crypto wallets and gas fees and all these other confusing things that when you're an artist, you don't want to have to worry about and research all these things. You just want to create art and see if, you know, people want to buy it and appreciate it. So it's a really interesting platform which I've been getting involved with, and I've been chatting a lot with a fellow artist called Trey Fisk, and I'll be interviewing him on the podcast today. He's got some interesting views on how to price your NFTs in this kind of landscape. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Trey Fisk. Oh, yes. And by the way, I'll be recording this in my car with my daughter in the back seat. I call her the producer. And there's a few bits I can't edit out, let's just say. So, bear with us, and I hope you find it a really informative podcast. I want to help you become a thriving artist, but in order to do that, Andy Marshall, needs to become a thriving artist myself. Or I'm just some random guy talking. So I've got to help me to help you become a thriving artist. Now, how do I do this? I've got no idea, but I've got plenty of ideas, if you can have them at the same time. And if I sound lost, you're right, but you can find me, your guide, at the fork in the road. Let's go.
Hi, everybody who's listening. My name is Trey. Currently, the focus of my work has been visual graphic illustration. So I went to school for my degree is visual arts. That's what they called it. That meant I did a lot of photography and film. That's what my focus was. I don't do a whole lot of that anymore, but you can find all of my illustrations and my graphics on my Instagram, which is really simple, really easy to remember. It's instagram.com/TreyFisk, spelled exactly the way my name will probably be spelled in the description of this. And if you're looking me up on Twitter, it's the same thing, but just add art onto the end and then you can find me there. And we were talking about NFTs, and we're going to talk a lot more about it probably today, but you can find all of my NFT work on voice.com/TreyFisk as well. I'm very fortunate to have claimed that name on all of these platforms, and hopefully no one tries to take that away from me anytime soon.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to be able to have an original name like that. You can just kind of claim
your space.
Yeah, I
never have to worry about somebody else having that name already. And even if they do, in Twitter, for example, I think there already was a Trey Fisk. Or maybe I made that a long time ago and I forgot about it. But you just tag another word onto the end and it seems to do the trick just fine.
Yeah. So Fisk is your actual name. What's the heritage behind that? Where do you?
Yeah. You know, I'm not too sure. It's Fisk is my last name. My first name, it's a nickname. It's Trey, but my full first name is Trey Byn, TRABYN. And there's absolutely no backstory on that. My dad was just really into this rock band called Yes. If anybody likes Yes. And their lead guitarist, his name was Trevor Rabin. So he just took the T from Trevor and popped it in front of Rabin, and he got my name. So yeah, I do go by Trey, though. It's much easier to remember, and it seems to be easier to spell phonetically. People seem to get there a lot faster. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And one thing that struck me about your work, I'm not sure whether I first found your work in the Discord, just for people so they know, Voice is a bit like OpenSea or any of those other kind of NFT platforms. Mm-hmm. And they have a very active Discord community. So I'm not sure whether I met you on Discord or just saw your art somewhere. But what struck me about it is that it's really What one thing I really love in art is it for it to be really striking and simple at the same time. And that's something that you do really well. And I suppose that comes from your, because you've got design background as well.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, first of all, thank you so much. That means a lot to hear that from you. And that's what I try to hit as much as possible. My father, you'll probably hear me refer to him a couple times tonight, just because he is a professional illustrator. So a lot of what I do is, I wouldn't say it's based on him. It's probably the opposite. In a lot of ways, I try to do antithetical work to what he does, but in the same way, you kind of end up doing a lot of similar things anyways. I don't know where I was going with that, but oh right. So he always told me that this beautiful acronym, which is it's called KISS, KISS, and it stands for Keep It Simple, Stupid.
Yeah,
And
I know that one well,
I've never had a mantra that stuck with me so long, because I'm sure that you get this experience when you're making stuff, is you sit down, you get to your computer, maybe you have a cup of coffee, you're doing your routine, and you start with one idea, and then you start tacking on other things. And as you're going along, you kind of get lost in yourself a little bit, and you get lost in the piece, and you end up with something that wasn't exactly what you were intending to make. And sometimes that works out for the better, but other times you've just overcomplicated it for yourself. So I try to keep things really simple, keep them really clean, and have a lot of focus on the intentionality of very few lines, but making sure that they're well placed. So I'm really happy that you enjoy that. Thank you.
Yep,
Oh,
that's
the
cool. I've just
producer's
had a
calling
I've just
it.
had a word from a producer.
It's fantastic. I don't know if you know this, but I work with kids. That's my day job. I'm a
Oh, cool.
babysitter and an after school art teacher. So I
Oh,
spend a lot of
awesome.
time with kids, and yeah, no, I and I love it when a kid is my producer too. That nothing beats that.
Yeah, we might leave a few entertaining bits in, but we'll see how we go. So, that's really cool to hear about your, inverted commas day job, because that's something I always, because part of this podcast is called The Fork in the Road Between Thriving and Starving Artist. And, one of the things is that how do you survive as an artist and thrive? And for some people like me, at the moment, I'm half stay at home dad and half do shifts at a cafe, cooking and stuff. And it's that stuff that you don't hear about. You see the polished piece of an artist. You see like the end product, but you don't realize but the mess that goes on behind the scenes. You think this person's got it all figured out. They're an artist. They're living off their art and all this kind of stuff. And I think it's important to let other artists know that, it can be hard to do it all. To do it, as a standalone thing. But also in this day and age, I think we're getting closer to a point where we can potentially do art as their sole career. And it sounds like you've found a good way of incorporating, working with kids and doing teaching art to kids. And also, oh man, is this gonna work, Rosie?
Oh no, it's the best. It's the best interview environment I could imagine. This is perfect.
Can you just take it a sec? Faye, what do you want, Rosie?
Of course.
I'm glad you're so understanding.
Oh my, you tell me about it. I actually just ran home. I work on month like most of the weekdays until like 8 or 9 p.m. because after teaching the after school classes, I do some babysitting at night, and it's a lot of work. I just what you were saying actually, and I think it's really relevant to obviously raising a kid as an artist as well. I was that kid at one point, and my dad was the artist who was at that fork in the road most of the time. very starving and not thriving as much. But you know, that changes slowly over time. But it reminds me of this golf course that was near where I used to live back up in Vermont. And it was this beautiful golf course in the middle of nowhere. You would have never expected it to be there. And I'm not necessarily a fan of golf. I don't watch golf. But I remember wondering why this golf course had these beautiful rolling hills and why it was so well kept compared to the shrubbery and all of the, you know, the brambles of bush around it. And I found out that it was actually an old landfill, and they just put a beautiful golf course on top of the dugout trash. And I think that's, honestly, that's what my journey in artistry has felt like, is most of the time, 90% of the time, is a lot of effort and that trash, and you have to pack it down, and it's very stressful. And at the end of the day, you have to roll this beautiful green turf over the top of it, dig out a little hole and stick a flag in. And then that little flag that's sticking out of the top, that's the part that you're hoping people are going to retweet and they're going to like and they're going to share around to their friends. And then you're going to get all of these sales. But that's really, it's not realistic. And honestly, I think it's pretty detrimental, because there are a lot of people who, you know, either want to be artists, or they want to go to art school, or they want to try to express themselves in some way. And they see all of these people who are acting like everything's perfect for them and their life is going amazing and it's so spectacular. Look at all these pieces of art I'm selling. But you know that there was a lot of time there where they were hurting a lot. And I think we need to start accepting that a little bit more and show that off too. That's why I love this too. It's great to hear your daughter in the car with you, because that's real life. That is who you are. You know, that's what's going on right now.
I kind of think as well, in the world of, you know, that we're quickly moving towards of artificial intelligence and art created by computers and things like that, is that the thing? I think people are going to enjoy that for a while, but I think what's going to bring people back to art is kind of like what brought people back to, you know, vinyl records and things like this. It's kind of that personal touch. It's the person, because when you're buying art, it's not just a picture on a wall or whatever. It is you're buying a part of a person's life, what was going on in their head. You're investing in that artist. Mm-hmm. You're doing all of these things that kind of means that, I think that's how like this kind of realism behind the facade is what I think is going to make artists stand out in the future. Like, yes, not people with a perfectly curated Instagram feed or anything like this. I mean, you know, their profile feed might be nicely curated, but in their stories or something, to be having, you know, like these behind the scenes recording a podcast in your car, or you know, have kids climbing all over your artwork while you're trying to do stuff and that, because that's what makes you real, that's what makes you relatable, and
exactly,
and can bring that story through. So I kind of roll with the mess.
And I think that's the best way to do it too, because that's genuinely where this art is coming from as well. I mean, I don't know about you, but some of the best things that I feel I come up with are things that I make in the middle of a highly tense time in my life, or, you know, on a day that I'm feeling really sad, or on a day that things weren't working out the way I wanted and I'm so preoccupied, and you're using art as a way to guide yourself through that. And if that's where the art came from, I think it's important to tell people that too, because that's also what they're buying. They're buying a little subjective snapshot of your psyche, of who you are, who you were at that moment when you made it. And that's a really precious thing to have. And I sometimes have a problem with getting too attached to pieces of mine. And there was a while where I had a bunch of pieces up on Voice and I hadn't listed any of them because I wanted them up there to be seen, but I didn't really want people to take them. And really, what does it mean when somebody buys an NFT? I mean, that's probably another conversation, but when I started trying to show off that raw, not even raw, but less curated part of myself, I felt a little bit better about the people who are buying it because I felt like they were purchasing it for the right reasons. But that's, I mean, yeah, it's, it, I think the unfortunate part about this facade that we feel like we need to put on is there's this idea of professionality, and you need to present yourself in a way that is digestible to people if you want to succeed, or at least that's what people think. And in some ways that's true because we do see formulas on Twitter of how people are posting certain things in certain ways, like using hashtags or making those art share threads or using their page in a very pragmatic way to stimulate more engagement. And that's great and all, but it kind of gets tiring too. And you start realizing that you're performing up on stage for a bunch of people who are absolute strangers to you. And do you really want to give those people all of that energy and attention when it's your real life that's making you make this art in the first place? Yeah, this is something that I think about a lot. And I don't really know if there's a clear answer to it, but all I can say is that I definitely want to try to combat what these, especially social media platforms, are trying to get us to do, and try to just show my art. And if people like it, they like it. And if they don't, well, that's fine. I'll keep making it.
Well, that's it. I mean, you can make it, and I mean, it's nice to have people buy your work. I mean, it's basically taken my art to a new level, in terms of me making money as an artist. Like, but the only money that I've made as an artist, is being paid to illustrate a couple of kids' books. And as soon as I got into the NFT space on Voice, like, people were starting to buy my illustrations, and I'm just like going, hang on a minute, this is just like
There's something here.
it's blowing my mind. It's like Instagram, but instead of people putting a thumbs up, they can actually like put up $5 or $10 or something
Yeah,
and say,
place a bid or
I like it that much that I'm gonna, put some money behind this and collect it. Like,
yeah.
it's, I don't know if it's, and it feels like a great way. Like, there's often, artists have got themselves out there and they've got their work, and their work's up there for hundreds or thousands of dollars, which is
Right.
great. I'm not saying you shouldn't charge a lot of money for your art. You should. But the other thing is, there's ways in which where you can, receive something which might be like a tip or whatever. If you're like busking in the street, like if you do a
Right.
thing of 100 editions or something, and I really like this guy, but I can't afford to buy his work. But you can sell NFTs as editions too. I'm really interested in your whole approach to Voice, actually, because I found you to be very interactive in the community. Very supportive. Like, not only are you creating art, you're buying art as well, and you've also got a bit of a philosophy behind, well, a philosophy or a system behind your process, where like if you've purchased someone's artwork and that resells, that you'll like invest 50% of that cost back into their artwork and things like that. So I'm really interested to hear what kind of system, because I love systems. I keep myself awake at night with systems, and I really love this feeling of like selling and purchasing at the same time, and like building a range of other people's artwork within my collection at the same time. But I want to hear it from you. I want to hear what you've got to say there.
No, I mean, it's a great question, and it's exhilarating for me. And I have to be careful because there are times where I buy a piece of art and I think, oh, gee, I definitely should not have done that. And it's because I de you know, full disclosure, I'm definitely on the starving end of the fork in the road. And that's not like a pity card or anything, but it is the reality. And I think that's the reality for most of us, is that we all have to have these day jobs and we have to do this stuff. But when I do make a sale, instead of going through the hassle of withdrawing it into my crypto wallet and selling that and then, you know, putting that back into my account. And there's been layers and layers of fees. One thing that I've done is just whatever ends up in the escrow, I do like to reinvest it into other people's work. And this is for a couple of reasons. And I can touch base on like the collecting portion of this first. And then the appraisal part of it is separate as well, like how I evaluate what I think the worth of a piece is. But first of all, voice, and we've talked about voice a couple times, and I'm not sure how much your audience knows about voice or how much you talk about the platform, but it's really great. It hits a lot of niches in the NFT market that, you know, gas-free minting. They pledge to be carbon neutral, which is a big problem. But one thing that they've done a lot of great work on is getting a lot of artists. I don't know how much work they've done into finding collectors, and that's fine. I understand they're a really young company, so that'll come in time, I think, naturally. And most collectors gravitate over to platforms like OpenSea anyways. But one thing that I really want to do is, since there isn't a lot of money circulating on the platform, if I do make a sale, if it's a piece of my own that sold, I'll typically do about 25% of that because I really do need the other 75%. Yeah. It's very helpful. And I'm not going to lie about that. In fact, there isn't a lot of people coming in and just collecting. And the people who are coming in and just collecting, because I haven't had any whales, this is the vernacular people use, buy my work. But there are a few people who bought the more expensive pieces of my work, you know, over $100. And so yeah. I go to their page because I obviously want to thank them and I want to tout them all over Twitter and say that you're the best, like, thank you, thank you. But they don't have any information anywhere. They haven't minted any of their own pieces. And they also don't resell the pieces that they've collected. So I don't really know what they're doing with the pieces that they buy, but yeah. It seems like a dead end. So I don't want to be another dead end in that. And I would love to take some of that to give some support to another artist. And it's not any tangible support in terms of money. It's not a lot of money, but it does provide that little bit of optimism that I think we all really need at different points throughout our journey of artistry. It's really a psychological, and it can be a torturous journey where your biggest enemy, your biggest obstacle is yourself and your own ability to be creative and to be inspired. And sometimes, whether we want to admit it or not, external validation is incredibly, incredibly important. And you do need to have somebody who sees you. And I particularly like to go and buy people's oldest pieces because those are the pieces that really don't get seen. And I think that gives the extra little flavor of satisfaction that somebody really is browsing and looking through my work, which I really am. And I have a lot of enjoyment scrolling through other people's profiles and just seeing what they have. As for secondary sales, I haven't sold any yet, and I'm not sure if that's a fault in my appraisal scheme, but I haven't sold any of those. If I do, then I'll take 50% of whatever I make and I'll buy more of that artist's work because it's important to bump up the value of their work and show that any money that's made off of a secondary sale, I still see value in your work and I want to naturally use that money to buy more of it. And it's a way to keep it clean, I think, and also to not take advantage of artists who are selling their pieces for $10 or $15, and then I mark it up to $250. I would feel really terrible if I pocketed $250 for a piece from a person that I now have gotten close to and have communicated with. I wouldn't want to pocket that money because that really isn't benefiting them at the end of the day. So.
It kind of is in a way. Like I've found in terms of like it's actually made me raise my prices, and it's funny because I've raised my prices and then my sales have dropped off, which understandably, you know, that's going to happen.
Yeah, there's going to be a little bit of a hump once you do that, but it levels out over time.
Yeah, because I've made it so cheap for a long time. Like I was following a couple of artists which I really dig their stuff, and they and they produce a lot of work, and they just, I mean, they're on OpenSea and other places, and they're doing exhibitions as well, and they're selling their work for, you know, thousands of dollars in exhibitions.
Yeah.
And then they've got original NFTs up for a buck. And so like I'm buying these NFTs for a buck, and it's funny because of the resells that have actually worked for me. Like I've put, you know, 1000% on them and they've sold.
You never know.
And so I was getting back to like the thing of, you know, because you've got a couple of my pieces and mm-hmm. you lifted
and you have
the
a couple
pri-
of mine as well.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I just want to say thank you so much for the Sue purchase. That one really took me by surprise. It hit me exactly where I was talking about. It was such a surprise and really made my day. So thank you so much.
Well, that work is just something that I think it was probably one of the first pieces I saw of yours and thought, wow, this is like really cool. This is,
wow.
I'm not sure how to explain it. It's kind of like, what would you say the influences of the style of that piece are? Would it be like?
Yeah. That one was interesting. I think I was, most of the pieces that I'm making as NFTs, because I do a lot of work that isn't NFT related as well, but the stuff that I do make that are NFTs, I try to get inspired by the pop culture, I guess, the zeitgeist of the NFT world. And there are a lot of portrait type things happening where series of a certain style of portrait are released. And I like to try to take that and I give it more of a fine art approach, I guess, where it's not a bunch of bored apes that are algorithmically mishmashed with different pieces. I'll do like a 5-part collection in that scenario, and I'll try to do something that's a little bit more fine-tuned and catered to the models. So all of those were people that I am close with and that I know. And it's not that I'm necessarily a dark artist. In fact, I try to make my pieces as colorful as possible whenever I can. But these pieces, I wanted to have a little bit more of a serious tone, something that was a little bit more candid and visible in the expression. And so that was more of a somber series that I did. Not sad necessarily, but I wanted something that reflected more of a serious tone, because I do try to be really cheerleadery on Twitter, that's for sure. And I think in real life, I do try to be really supportive, especially for other artists. And maybe that's just been burned into me after enough time. But I do have a more serious approach as well to what I'm making. And it doesn't always come from a happy place, you know? So that was probably the expression most attached to those pieces.
I think that's one of the reasons it really stood out to me as well, because I mean, I am a massive fan of black and white imagery. Like I come from film school. And,
hey, me too. Wow. Holy moly.
And I am like, my favorite films are black and white films, and not just old black and white films, modern black and white films. I just find it again, it's that simplicity. It kind of brings everything down to just, you know, black and whites and grays, and it forces you to, you know, really look at the picture that's there.
And you look at the shapes more. Contrast.
And it also has that kind of those pieces of yours has this kind of, for me it had kind of like an old school black and white film feel with a bit of glow behind the character, you know, because I was a projectionist as well for 20 years. And so like I've been projecting, you know, celluloid film. So, you know, I kind of romantically kind of go for celluloid-y kind of, you know, old school black and white kind of things.
That was exactly what I was trying to, I had so much trouble finding a background that I felt suited it. And that was really what I was actually inspired by, were the old slide plate cameras that they would have, where there was that big metal plate that they would slide in. And then when, I forget what the chemical is, I never took an analog class, unfortunately. I was always a digital
filmmaker. Is it the silver silver.
Yeah, the silver something, silver nitrate, or something that's explosive. I know that.
Oh yeah, well, the nitrate films, right at the beginning of cinemas. They would burn down cinemas on a regular basis.
And you had to be so careful moving them as well. They would just go off from the slightest spark of friction.
Yeah. Sounds like great entertainment to bring the family to, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So anyways, that was the inspiration for that. And I just wanted to touch base on, just back up a little bit, because you were talking about the way that I bumped up the prices of the pieces that I got from you. And I think that there's a way to have both, like to have your cake and eat it too, where you're increasing what you perceive to be the value of this artist's work, which oftentimes is more reputable to collectors than the artist's evaluation of their own work. And that's kind of, that's the role of an auction house. And we talked about this a little bit, but I did work in fashion auction for a while. And then for a brief stint, I did an auction internship here in New York. And that was something that became really noticeable to me. This is also why all of my pieces I auction instead of sell off at a flat rate for the most part. I like the idea of having the crowd decide the value of the piece. So that way I don't have to take that into account myself. And even if I disagree with what something goes for in an auction, at least I know that it's not something that's necessarily arguable. It's nobody can come and be mad at me about it, at least. And you can't really dispute what the outside perspective is on the evaluation of your art, because those are the people who are going to be buying it. You unfortunately can't buy your own art. So that's why I think it's really important to do auctions specifically. And I do have a tendency, especially with one of one art, which is, for anybody who doesn't know, we talked about this a little bit too. You can mint your pieces in editions, and you can sell off 100 copies of the same NFT for a lower price point. But then there are artists who do one of ones as well. And this is why I really had such a liking towards your illustrations, the hand illustrations, is because that is, it's really unique. First of all, it's completely individual to you. It's something that couldn't be copied. And taking all of the NFT crypto mysticism out of it, this is the only copy of it that you're selling. And that makes it more valuable to me as a collector. This isn't the case for all collectors, I'm sure. But for me, at least, I like to know that when I resell this piece, or when I try to resell this piece, I will be able to make a decision on the evaluation, as opposed to looking at all of the other editions of something and seeing what other people are selling it for, because that's really stifling too. I have a lot of pieces that I gave out as giveaways, and I have no expectation of anybody selling those at all. But I do know that it gets under some artists' nerves when they see something that they minted 10 versions of, and one person is trying to sell it for $500. Another person is trying to sell it for $3. And then there's a person who's selling a copy of it for $1. And it's a little bit of a punch to the gut, I think. And that's really avoidable. Honestly, it's just avoidable if you buy a one of one. And maybe that's just self-preservation. I don't want to get on the wrong side of history here, but it makes it a safer bet. And then in terms of the actual appraisal and evaluation of the piece, I don't really have a formula for that, and I probably should, but I've been exposed to enough graphic design work through my father, who is an artist, and I've seen how he evaluates his work for, you know, the last couple decades, and also when he tries to sell other people's pieces, how he evaluates them. And I think the only rule of thumb that I can come up with is try to sell it for a lot of money first. Just try. Try to go and put it up there for $300 or $400 or $500. And if you don't sell it, you don't sell it. That's fine. In another couple months, you lower it a little bit. And eventually, with enough pushing and trying to find the right buyer, because that takes some effort too, you're going to sell it for more money than you were expecting to begin with. You just have to be really patient. And you have to be optimistic and give the piece the benefit of the doubt. Because if you bought it, if your taste was you saw this piece and you liked it and you wanted to buy it, as an artist, you should hopefully trust your taste. And you should also hope that other people share a similar one as well. So it's a matter of time. And you just have to let it do its thing. You have to let the art just be the art, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there really seems to be two approaches, and I personally started off on the right track, and then I got diverted by little dopamine hits that would, you know, come to me every time someone would put a bid on something, and I think that's a trap, because like, so I started off, you know, and I was just doing, I put up my very first one was $5, and then it ended up going for $10 at auction, and then it kept on going up, and they got up to about $20, but I kept on bringing it up, and I should have kept on that. I should have just stayed on that path, but then I'd have like a couple that I'd like put in for like $1, and then I'd get a few people bidding on them, and you know, and gradually I just kind of killed my killed the value of my work over time.
That can happen.
But by producing too much and starting it all at a low price, and then thinking, well, you know, people will bid for what it's worth. But I don't know. It's a really, and the funny thing is that I think it's important to bring up is that it's very it feels good when you get a bleep on your phone. You go, someone's bid on your work. Someone bids on your work, and like you know, in the end, you've sold it for like you know $2.50 or something. But
yeah, and that serotonin rush was worth 100.
and the funny thing is, this whole podcast is based around you know not starving as an artist, but actually thriving. And I think it's a really I've looked at some artwork which is sold for, you know, $800 or something like that. And I'm just investigating and going back and going, they posted this like back in, you know, 4 or 5 months ago, you know, it's been sitting there. Like I was getting with my low bids, I was getting turnarounds of like, you know, it'd be sold within the day, you know. Patience is the key.
Patience is the key, and it's especially tricky again when it's your own work that you're trying to value, because you can do exactly what you said and drive down the perceived value of your work if you're posting is really quickly and you're listing them for $5 a piece. That can be really exciting at first because you're getting a lot of purchases and there's a lower threshold for somebody to want to buy that piece because it's less expensive. But at the same time, then you're kind of building, there's an inertia that's attached to that, because then all of your future pieces that you're going to create, if you have one piece that's $40 and a sea of $5 pieces, chances are most of those $5 pieces are going to sell. And the $40 one is just going to be that, you know, apple at the bottom of the barrel. And that can be a difficult trap to get out of. There's a couple things that I've noticed with other artists. And again, this is always a big experiment and I don't have any answers for it. I don't think anybody does. We're all trying different things out. But there are some people who will mint a bunch of pieces, but they won't list them. And they'll just have them at the top of their library, of their collection. And as they sell pieces, make other ones available. And I think this is kind of, if I'm interpreting this correctly, is a means of artificially creating a supply versus demand dynamic, where you're trying to limit the amount of supply to increase the demand or to make the perceived value increase so that way the demand rises. But, you know, if you're doing that, then it's probably less likely you're going to be getting a bid every day. You're going to be looking at a bid every couple months. And again, it's not one size fits all. That seems to be one way to be able to, you know, slowly increase the value. But honestly, I think a lot of it just has to come over a very slow period of time where I've seen artists who start off selling $5 pieces and then, you know, a couple months later it's up to 10 and a couple months later it's up to 15. And that seems to work too, because you're still selling within the range of your audience and you're not really losing their trust by jacking up your prices. But at the same time, you're easing into this new professional self of yours where you do want to value your work at a certain point, because you're the one who's making it. And if you want to have a life doing this, you deserve that. So unfortunately, it's not always up to you when that happens, but it's a slow process. And I'm one of those artists that came into all of this without any portfolio of work prior, nothing that I was going to show off. I didn't have any followers anywhere. All of this started really cold for me. And that's the process that I've been going through, where I started off minting things at a very low price point. And then I had like a phase where I was putting things up for like $1,000 in this cocky, overconfident way, thinking, well, you know, there's going to be a whale out there who sees this and they're going to buy it. And that never happens. That never happens. But then you take those mistakes and you take the hits and you slowly level out and you balance out. And right now, I think for me, at least, the mark of my work, the things that sell the best are around $20. You know, it's not a lot. But I make sure to sprinkle throughout my page a handful that are over $100 or over $200. And I make sure that it's noticeable there's a different amount of effort put into those, that it took a different amount of technical skill, or it's not just monochromatic, or there's not just two colors. I make sure that there's multiple and there's more technical aspects to it. And then if those things don't sell, that's all right. Because it's just, it's going to sit there and it's going to sit there. And I know that I have smaller pieces to buffer the in-between. That's really worked well for me. But it does take a lot of hands-on work. And you have to really be paying attention to the tides. And sometimes you don't have that time on your hands.
One thing I was thinking about that I love about NFTs is that it feels like an investment in your future, because... Mm-hmm. Because any resale of your work, you get 10% back kind of forever, which is 10%'s not a lot, but it's a hell of a lot more than what you would have been getting selling your art at the local gallery. You get nothing. So, and so that was another approach of mine in my head, is that like, how can I create lots and lots of pieces and kind of have them out there so that like in the future, if you know my books become popular or something like that, that you know that'll raise the value of them, and then it will create this passive income through there.
That's so the dream.
I mean, that's, I go through all these stages of going, what approach am I actually going to take here? And what you've tended to do by when you've bought my pieces, you've raised the value. And I just got to a point where I just thought, I don't need the dopamine hits anymore. I'm just going to, and I work in a cafe. So I don't need to sell these to eat. And so I'll just bring the value up to kind of match or kind of be in a range of where other people are relisting my work, because that's an indicator of where people think that there might be, you know, the value of your work. So if you bring it up to meet that, then as people are scrolling through all your works that are for sale from yourself and from other people, there feels to be some consistency there and value there. But the only problem is, you know, like I've gone from, you know, selling stuff from $5 to like up to, you know, $50 and $100. It's a big jump, so I'll probably have to sit. I'll probably have to sit on it for a few months. But
Those, it's going to take a while, maybe, for those ones to sell. But you never know. And also, you said something that's really important, and a lot of people want to know, you know, how these people are selling these pieces for $800, $700, and they're waiting so long. Well, it's because It's because they have a day job too. And
yeah.
if you can find a day job, this is a really important part for any artist, whether you're doing digital art or you're doing NFT. This is from the perspective of somebody who went to a four-year art school and really regrets it, because I felt it was a waste of time and a lot of money that I had no business to spend. The best thing that you can do for yourself to have the freedom to make art is to make sure that all of your other bases are covered. If you're making art and you're constantly stressed out and it's a necessity for you to sell this art, then it's not going to happen, because it's going to come across that way. You have to make sure that your life is taken care of, so that way when you're making the art for the sake of making the art, because you enjoy making the art, not because you're hoping to make X amount of money out of it, because you have that day job, you have the luxury of not worrying about making X amount of money out of your art. But then when it does happen, it's frosting on the cake, as opposed to, you know, the batter before it's baked. There's a big difference. And I think that that's an unspoken secret. You don't have to get a great job. It doesn't have to even be 40 hours a week. I work with kids and babysit all sorts of random families, whatever hour I can squeeze it in. And then I do the exact same thing with my art, which I'm not sure if that's necessarily a good approach, but you know, I get a few hours here, a few hours there that I can squeeze something in, or at least get some progress in. And I'm at least using that very precious time in my day to make art because I enjoy making it. And it's not always like that. It's not perfect. There are days where life is just really difficult and you can't enjoy making that art. And seeing a sale would really make those clouds part and have the sun shine right back through on you. But you know, you just have to make sure that art aside, you're taken care of. So that way you don't have to be selling a bunch of pieces at $1. You can give yourself that fair evaluation. And when it happens, it's going to feel like a pot of gold, as opposed to something that you had to shill and get on your knees and beg for somebody to buy it or do this or do that. It just feels like a healthier process. And I guess I only say that because there are a lot of unhealthy traps, especially on social media and with the pace of work that's in the NFT world. You said that you went to film school as well, so you really understand, and this was something that I struggled with graduating, was the scope and scale of projects that I used to work on. They would take a year to plan, and you'd have multiple people who are collaborating in different capacities and different departments. And you write a script, and then you get that edited, and then you get together your crew and you do your crew call, and then you film, and then you bring it to the editing department. And then 2 years goes by and you finally have one 15-minute short film that you are ready to show to everybody. Here in the NFT world, I have 2 hours and I'm like, all right, shit, how am I going to get this together and make something that's going to sell? And that's not realistic, and that's not healthy. And there are people who make a living doing that. But those are the people who have algorithms and computers making all of these different combinations of Bored Apes on their behalf. They're not making all these millions. There's something else that's happening behind the scenes. So this really fast pace that we grow accustomed to, where I need to get as many pieces out as fast as possible at a low enough price point that people will buy a bunch of it, so it's just circulating around and I make a name for myself, that's fantastic. And I've done that too, but you also have your life, you know, and it's really easy to get sucked into that serotonin rush. That's precisely what the app was designed to create. That's precisely what it's trying to accomplish, is this addictive feedback loop where there's diminishing returns and you're always trying to beat this algorithm. And the only way to do it is to post 15 times a day. And oh my gosh, pretty soon you're ripping your hair out and you haven't made a single sale. And you're wondering, what is all of this even for? I've gotten to this point so many times. I think a lot of us have. And so we really need to challenge that. One thing I've done that's really specific that helps with this is I've kind of gone on a hashtag strike, which is really silly and doesn't really accomplish a whole lot. But using these hashtags, you get all of these bots and all of these fake accounts that are liking you. And every time your phone vibrates, you have to put down whatever you're working on. You have to unlock it and look and see who liked it. And then it's some person with one follower and it's absolutely a bot. But they just took your attention away, and they took your entire focus away from your expression of yourself. And after a point, I got sort of uncomfortable with the idea that anybody, even a robot, was having that effect on me. And so there are a lot of traps, I guess, is what I'm saying. And the more we can challenge that, even if it's a harder path to take, less sales, slower time frame, I do believe that there's a lot more longevity to that. And I think that the quality of the work you're making will continue to increase under that premise naturally. Whereas if you're building or creating stuff for quantity as opposed to quality, it's going to have the inverse effect. Not necessarily, but it very well could.
Yeah. Yeah, I think because the NFT space is relatively new, people who weren't necessarily considering themselves artists have come in and gone, well, I can create a whole bunch of these and they will sell. And in a way, there's always two sides to the story, to the coin, or whatever you want to say, is because I think that is brilliant, because someone who's never really, you know, did a bit of art when they're at school or whatever, thought, I'm going to create some art. And that is an amazing thing, because I think everybody should create art, because it's great, because it's great for your mental health and all those kinds of things. Oh, and just for your self-expression. But the flip side of that is that a lot of those people aren't doing it for self-expression.
Right.
They're doing it for a quick buck. Yeah. And because it's a new thing, they're going, how can, and they see, they read stories of people making millions of dollars overnight. Of the NFT world. And they're going, you know, that could be me. I've got to jump on the new thing. And I agree that, yes, you do have to jump on the new thing and you have to be invested. But I think that's going to people, because already NFTs have got this reputation with fine artists and whatever as being absolute shit. Yeah. And to tell you the truth, a lot of the time, like I'm not going to tell someone their art is shit, but in a way, like you have to think of what is behind the art that's created. And if it's an artist that has created it and someone who's been, you know, investing time into being an artist, then I think that that's where the true value is going to start to rise. And I also think the value of quantity is probably, you know, it's going to always have its level and flatten out a bit. But I think I think there is potential for like a lot of one of one work that is really amazing work, because it's just such a new space. I don't think artists are willing to invest in creating a piece of work just to be an NFT.
Right.
But as soon as they do start to embrace that and go, I'm going to create a digital piece of art that is just a digital piece of art. It's not a painting. It's not a print. It's not of this. It's of that. And they've put lots of hours into it. And it's obviously, you know, a beautiful piece of work which says something. Mm-hmm. I think that's when kind of it'll raise the profile of NFTs, because I think NFTs have got a pretty shit rap.
That's very true. And you see that not just with fine artists, but you see that with even people who are associated with cryptocurrency, who were just cryptocurrency investors. They have issues with NFTs as well. It definitely has a bad rap. And one thing that some people do to bolster the value of their pieces is there's, you know, a lot of platforms have a utility component or some sort of unlockable content. I'm not sure if you use that feature, but I personally don't. It's not because I don't want to give them something else, you know, attached to it, but a lot of these unlockable things are invites to Discords, or they're invites to other communities, or you get perks to certain things or whatnot. I would really love to get to a point, and I fully agree with you on this, where the art itself stands by itself. And you don't necessarily need to incentivize a purchase of it. And there doesn't have to be something else that's attached. Because I think where NFTs really first, you know, it's really a gold rush in a lot of ways, how this is all turning out. But one of the first things that was really profitable, I think, was people using NFTs as tokens that you could redeem for games or this thing that we call the metaverse or Web3, where you buy this ticket and now all of a sudden you have a plot of land in this virtual space. And pretty soon people thought, well, hey, this is a really great way to sell our art too. But I don't think you need to do that either. And the only reason why I'm saying this is because there's a lot of pressure to do what everybody else is doing. But I do think that we're starting to get to a point very slowly, because this is early, early, early days. And there's hopefully a long road ahead where, you know, more people start coming into this space and giving it a better reputation. But hopefully we get to a point where the art stands by itself, and collectors will look at this similarly to buying a piece of traditional art that they found hanging in a gallery that they can now display in their collection. And they're coming up with creative ways to show that too. There's a lot of spatial galleries. I'm not sure if you've seen those either, where, you know, you walk through a digital room and you can walk up to people's NFTs, and if you click on them, it'll redirect you to where you can buy it. And so we're getting there. We're starting to have.
Are these physical spaces or virtual spaces?
These are virtual space. I mean, they have physical ones too, where there's a QR code and you can probably scan it and buy the NFT. But there's one in particular that I've seen. I think it's spatial.io, I think is what it's called. And you can use some of the galleries for free. Some of them you have to pay with crypto to unlock and add them to your wallet or whatever. But walk through and invite other people into your gallery, your digital gallery, and they can walk around and you can see other people walking around in the gallery, and you can walk up to pieces and do showcases. I think that there's a lot of ingenuity left to be had, and I think there's going to be a lot of improvements, but that excites me, for example, because it brings this traditional classic gallery feel, which is a place that I feel very comfortable in, and it tries to emulate that in a digital space, which can be really terrifying a lot of the time. It makes it feel a little bit more natural, I guess, which is going to be essential if they want to get more fine artists and traditional artists to start minting their pieces digitally. They have to compromise with what already exists to some extent. Otherwise, those fine artists will continue to hang their oil on canvas on the wall and, you know, shit talk OpenSea or Ethereum or whatever, you know, whatever it is. But again, it's super early days. I think there's a lot of progress to be made. Hopefully one day collectors just come and see this as buying a piece of original artwork that they can then display. And I think maybe we can expect that in the next couple of years, hopefully.
Yeah. I think it will kind of pan out and it will run its course and hopefully become more of a legitimate art space, because I haven't personally, I have owned a couple of people's pieces of art before, but this has kind of reinvigorated the idea for me, because, you know, I live out in the country in Australia, and not really many art galleries or any places you can buy physical art. And it's kind of nice to buy a piece, but not only buy a piece because it's a cool piece and you really appreciate it, but you know that artist really appreciates that boost of a sale, not only financially, but they go, well, yeah, this person believes this is worth a value, and that's nice as well. And I think that whole kind of thing of not only being an artist producing, but being an artist producing and collecting, it's kind of
Yeah.
gives that, you know, if you work out your ratio so you don't blow all your money collecting as well, which I kind of have done a little bit recently,
Yeah, I've tipped into
is
that
it.
water a couple times.
And it's that kind of old idea of, you know, of a rising tide, you know, lifts all boats kind of thing. Is that like, you know, well, we're all kind of helping one another and recognizing one another and kind of lifting each other up, which I think is, you know, is I think it'll work, and I think it's kind of it's a nice environment to be in, and it's been a very supportive community on Voice for sure. Which I don't know anything about OpenSea,
Yeah, I don't
and
really know much either about it. I've pretty much stuck just with voice for the most part. I think it's again my own lack of knowledge of cryptocurrency. I'm not particularly knowledgeable about the fundamental workings of blockchain. All of this sounds crazy to me. I just saw voice as a really easy way to not pay money and make an NFT, and hopefully somebody will buy it, which every once in a while that happens, you know. So that's
I mean, me too. Like, it was that thing of like, so I could see, because I was following. Do you know the artwork of Beeple?
Oh yes, yeah. And
Yeah,
also the famous, what was it, a Sotheby's auction?
that went for millions. I don't know, lots of millions, just a
Yeah.
ridiculous amount. I can't even.
69 million or 68 million or something like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
But anyway, I was following this guy on Twitter just because he did really kind of weird stuff.
Yeah.
And
Oh, I'm such a fan.
yeah, and then I heard of a sale, and then I saw him on Joe Rogan, and I really get a feel that, you know, I have to be involved, like, because like I'm always taking on the latest trend, because I feel that's kind of what you need to do. But the whole thing which was keeping me back was all this kind of, you got to get a crypto wallet, you got to do this, you got to do that, and like, and I'm hearing lots of stories from people that just go, I just lost $500 trying to set up an account,
Oh,
and shit like that, and they go, I can't afford to just lose a few hundred bucks setting up
yeah,
an account.
no
And that,
position for that.
yeah, and then Voice came along and go, you set up the account, zero fees. And the icing on the cake for me is that, because I've heard people talking about damage to the environment from carbon emissions. And initially I thought, how does a digital file ruin the planet? Surely it's better for the planet because you're not printing and you haven't got inks and you. But I suppose if it works, it's got to be kept on servers and stuff. So,
Yeah, apparently it's a lot worse than I thought, that's for sure. I it still baffles me. It blows my mind just how much energy it takes. And yeah, it's really counterintuitive as well to what you would expect to be the case, but it's fantastic that they've figured out a way to make that work. I'm not technically knowledgeable enough to say if that's true or not. I mean, I wish I could ask more critical questions of them about how that works or what they're doing, but I just have to take their word for it. I'm sure that they're doing a better job than most places, and that progress is all you can ask for.
They're making an effort, and that's a good start.
A couple of things right before we wrap up. The first thing is that the NFT world, any art world, and we always say NFT, but really, because we assume that all these problems that existed with traditional art no longer exist there, like gatekeepers or people taking advantage of art, all of these things also exist in NFTs the same way that they existed with traditional art. It's not always a fair game, I guess is what I'm saying. And to expect that one person is going to get the same treatment as another person, even if their art is technically and just, you know, off of first sight, way better than another person's piece, that does not at all mean that they're going to get more money for it. A lot of those really big sales, unfortunately, are friends who have other friends make a purchase on their behalf just to, you know, stack up their stats on whatever platform. And they can do that because they're rich and because they already had a lot of money and they can do that and it's not a problem. So I guess don't always, if anybody's listening, I'm just saying this to the audience, don't always believe what you see, especially in a world of strangers in a digital landscape. There are nightmare stories. There's so many. And it's because people can get away with a lot of stuff online. So just keep your nose to the ground, focus on yourself, and whatever happens will happen. And as long as you enjoy making the art, then there's no way you would ever waste your time doing this because you're already doing something that you enjoy. And that's the only marker that matters. And the final thing, and I can't take credit for this, and I'm going to butcher the saying, but and I don't really care for Andy Warhol all that much. I'll just say that too. But he did say something that was really amazing, which was make art and show it to people while they're making up their mind about whether or not they like the art you've made. Make more art.
I did see that one recently. That's a good one.
It was just it made so much sense. I heard it, and again, I didn't say it the way I'm supposed to, but I think the point gets across that it's not really up to you. You don't have the responsibility, nor will you ever have the power to make somebody's mind made for them about your piece. That's as soon as they see it, that ball is in their court. All you can do, all you've ever been able to do, is make your own work. So as long as you're doing that, the rest will come.
If people are interested in collecting work from other artists, I think it's really important that you find cool pieces, but not only find cool pieces, find their social media accounts, go into their social media accounts, and make sure that there's a real person attached at the end of that piece of artwork. And it just hasn't been created on fabricated accounts of people stealing other people's artwork, because I would say the percentage of stolen artwork in the NFT world would be at least probably 50 to 70%. So you've got to be careful when you're collecting, or you could end up buying a whole bunch of just stolen work that's not worth anything.
Exactly.
And supporting a system which isn't. I know I've done a few, I've made a few purchases and just gone, that's, that person's actually ripping off that.
Yeah. And then you realize and you feel kind of secondhand guilt because you didn't, you know, that's happened to me too. I didn't do my due diligence. I sent Voice an email and I was like, is there any way that I can burn someone else's NFT? This wasn't theirs to sell to me to begin with. So I don't really want it.
That's probably the work you should put up for $1 and actually not have it as an auction, but have it as a sale. I'm selling this for 50 cents and just...
as a finger, a middle finger to them.
Yeah, get it out of your collection as well. I don't want
as soon as possible. Yeah, anyways.
I feel dirty. I feel dirty. I have stolen goods.
I need to walk my hands and make a new wallet now because I can't get rid of this. My name is on the provenance forever.
Yeah.
And one more thing for the one more thing. Definitely do your due diligence and look into the artist. And most of the time, I'll just speak on my behalf. I can't speak for you, but send us a message or reach out to us and say hi, because I know that a lot of us are more than happy to talk about what we're doing and to answer any questions. And it's a really good way to feel like you're more connected with the artist as well as the artwork that they're making. I will say, as a collector, or in my small capacity of collecting, I have not ever bought a single piece from an artist I haven't spoken with before. I make sure that every piece I buy is from an artist that I at least introduced myself to and got to hear a little bit more about themselves, that the majority of collectors that would be in a similar boat to that, unless these are the multimillionaires who are just going and buying full collections. Those people, I have no idea what they're thinking, and we probably shouldn't even waste our time trying to, but say hi to us and we're always happy to say hi back.
and in the end, really, a large part of art is storytelling and whatever. So like the fact that art should start a conversation, I think, is really cool. And not just like if you're at a gallery with friends, you might start a conversation with your friends about a piece of artwork. But what's brilliant about the, you know, being the world we live in today is you can have that conversation with the actual artists as well. So it kind of brings it to a more personal level. So yeah, it's an exciting time we live in, in terms of being able to get your artwork out to the world, not in terms of global pandemics or wars or anything, but all that aside, you know, it's a great time to be an artist.
Yeah, if you can just pull the wool over your eyes and look only at the paper in front of you, it's a wonderful life. And enjoy it.
Yeah, cool, awesome. Well, we'll catch you later.
Yeah, sounds good. We'll talk soon.
Okay, see ya.
See ya.
And that just about wraps up today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. And if you want to start talking, I'd love you to leave me a voice message. All you have to do is tap the link at the bottom of the podcast description and you'll be able to leave me a 1 minute message there. It could be a question, your thoughts, praise, outrage. I don't care. I just want the attention. And I'll play the message back on the show and I'll catch you tomorrow at the fork in the road.